Welcome, everyone, to the Faith Recovery Podcast, where we are seeking to recover faith by recovering the faith. We have been studying John together, themes in John, and we're sort of nearing the end. I think we've got a couple more to record. Today we're going to talk about, I think, the sovereignty of God, the themes of light and darkness.
Yeah. I mean, you didn't acknowledge that we've been off for a couple of weeks, Kent.
Well, guys, we've missed you. Have you missed us?
Absence makes a heart grow fonder.
Yeah. Sorry, you know, we are only human. We have things that come up, and we just haven't been able to publish every single week. Hope you're still there out there, people listening. So, Nathan, what did you have in mind when you talked about light and darkness?
Yeah, good question, Kent. The themes pervade the book of John, right? The idea of light, and Jesus is the light of the world. And John, as we've mentioned many times, opens his book with light shines in the darkness.
Yeah.
The creation narrative, especially the one, you know, from Genesis 1, seems to run behind a lot of John's exposition of the Christ event.
Uh-huh.
Right? First John, you know, this is the testimony, right? Light, you know, the light's coming to the world, right? And we've seen it. And so light and life, these are synonymous. We talked about how Jesus becomes the vessel, the emissary of this divine life, which John calls light, right? It is the revelation of the divine nature and the purpose of all that is created, and so light, right? Light exposes, illuminates, reveals. It reveals the ugly things. Mm-hmm. So Jesus speaks of, this is the judgment. The light's come into the world, and people prefer darkness,
uh-huh.
Right?
So your point is that we understand light as revelatory.
Mm-hmm.
But now, did you want to say that light and darkness also have something to say about the sovereignty of God?
Yes.
Like God breaks through the darkness with mm-hmm. his light, and that's his sovereignty.
Yes, but God also retains the darkness, at least for a period.
Mm.
So, and again, that gets back to the Genesis 1, you know, John's exposition of the Old Testament doesn't necessarily have to get very far out of the first few verses for him to really begin to see Jesus in those early passages. And so, as we've mentioned in John 1, around, you know, verse whatever it is, 6 or 7, where he says that the light, you know, the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness hasn't overcome it. So, mastered it.
Comprehended it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, apprehended it, comprehended it, right? It means kind of both things. It didn't understand it. It didn't imbibe that light. It was blind to that light. So, you know, light can shine, but if someone doesn't have the faculty to see, and blindness is also mentioned, right? Mm-hmm. Jesus heals a blind man, but then he also declares that those who claim to be able to see are themselves blind.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They've chosen not to see. They've turned away from the light. They've lost the capacity to even perceive light while staring into a light source, the scriptures. Okay? And so that's also part of the theme. But when John is expositing Genesis 1, you know, light breaks into the darkness in Genesis 1, right? So, you know, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and, you know, there was darkness over the face of the void, and the Spirit was hovering over the waters, and God said, let there be light. But God doesn't dispel darkness entirely, right? He mm-hmm. separates the light from the darkness, and he gives them names, right? He calls the night, the light day and the darkness night. And these become environments for the day four creations of the sun, moon, and stars, right? And mm-hmm. so they, just like God divides the water, you know, above the vault and the water below, and you know, so there's the sky and the sea and the birds. And on day five, you have the fish and the birds, and mm-hmm. then day three, you have the dry land comes out, and now you have on day six humankind and the animals, right? Mm-hmm. So light and dark, at least from the Genesis 1 account, are not necessarily, don't necessarily have a moral implication. But John would say that the way we experience creation is revelatory, you know? So looking up in the night sky, we would see that there are lights that are in the darkness. So the moon and the stars are these lights to govern the night, mm-hmm. right? These lesser lights. And yet, at the same time, we know that the greater light is coming, and it when it comes into full light of day, and when it rises, the darkness will be dispelled. And so mm-hmm. we have this sermon of sorts being proclaimed. Mm-hmm. If we were to stay up for 24 hours or yeah. whatever, or if we begin our day at 6 p.m. like the Jews did, right? Mm-hmm. Especially in the winter, we would begin with a very deep experience of darkness and a prolonged experience of darkness. Where there's light shining, but it's still dark, you know. Mm-hmm. And we would look toward the east, you know, and there would be this great hope. And we would see something like the morning star come up, you know, Venus. And so these precursors that happen as the day is coming. Mm-hmm. And then first light, where we don't see the sun yet, but it, you know, the light of day begins to break. And then finally sunrise, where darkness is dispelled, right? So John seems to set things in this kind of milieu, right? and the, you know, the metaphors are somewhat mixed and other things, but all that to say is that God has a role for the dark as he has a role for the light. God is operating in the darkness as he is in the light, both physically as we experience light, you know, night and day. And, you know, when, according to Revelation, when Christ returns, there's no night, at least in the city. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that nature's going to be totally suspended and the sun's just going to beam on us all the time. You know, I think that in the renewed earth, night and day are still going to happen. It's just that in Jerusalem, where there's this inexhaustible light source, that it'll always be light, you know. At any rate, so, but as far as moral darkness, right, just ignorance of God, let's say, because remember, light is revelatory. It shines on that which we would want to hide, but it also shines on that which ought to be seen, which must not be obscured, and that is ultimately the glory of God, who he is. Mm-hmm. And that becomes kind of the overarching protocol to the book of John, and I think all creation, is that the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the Lord, right? That this light is going to cover every place on the planet. People are aware of who and what God is, and in knowing him, they do see his glory, so he's glorified. Mm-hmm. And in seeing his glory, they are drawn to him and are themselves glorified and drawn into that reality, you know. So this light's multiplying. So when I say that God's sovereignty is over the light and the darkness, what I'm saying is that God has decreed not only that there be light in the dark, you know, that there be light in the dark, but in doing so, that the dark must be retained for a period of time, and that God has a purpose and a role for the dark. And now I'm speaking morally. Mm. Okay. So, and that's kind of a theme in John, where those who are blind and evil, those who have a measure of power or position, something that they're trying to protect, those people are repeatedly, continuously the enemies of Christ throughout the book, even from early on, right? Because mm-hmm. we get the kind of the insidious, that kind of unsettling mention that Jesus doesn't trust humankind because he knows what's in them. You know, that there's some kind of poison there. Mm-hmm. And we think, well, that's lamentable. But, and we could get into this notion that if there's evil in the world and God is all good, that God must be in a battle with the evil, and just the powers of evil are strong enough that there's some sort of a war going on, right? That we may be left with that impression, and that sometimes the devil wins some and sometimes God wins some. You know, there's, you can probably get a wallpaper for your computer of the devil and Jesus arm wrestling, mm-hmm. you know? And so, oh my gosh, you know, what a crazy, crazy notion.
Yeah. So like the dualism that we tend to fall into, if we're not careful, we might see it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Your point is that it's not true. That's not the case.
Mm-hmm. Right. And there's another kind of dualism that would say, well, light and dark are both good, right? Like yin and yang, Eastern mysticism or whatever. So that we would say, well, there is non-duality or whatever that, you know, when a painful thing happens, we'll say, well, that wasn't a bad thing. That was ultimately a good thing, you know, and that there's not blame or whatever, but these are all just a part of who and what we are, and darkness must exist so that light must. So you think about, you know, the Force in Star Wars, and it's got a dark side and a light side. Now, the dark side's obviously evil, but it also, the attempt is to bring balance, quote unquote, right? Mm-hmm. So you don't want to eradicate what's dark. You just want it in balance with what's light.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so both must exist in an Eastern duality, right? Or some would say a non-duality. From like a Buddhist perspective, they would say, well, there is no good or bad. There's just what is, right?
Mm-hmm.
And all of these are ways that we struggle with things that are very painful. You know, things like what have happened down in Kerrville, Texas, right? And how do you process that? I don't really honestly mean to try to offer a solution to that one particularly. I probably bit off more than I can chew with that one. But when it comes to human evil, you know, when people do things that are bad, how does God allow them to do it, right? Because so we watched the show Young Sheldon. It's on reruns, you know, or whatever now. And so Sheldon's, you know, a child prodigy, but, you know, with that is he's also a persistent atheist. And, you know, that's the bit where he's always asking the preacher these hard questions and taking him to task, you know, because his logic's so much more sound than the preacher's and everything. The preacher's kind of a joke. And but at one point, the lesson is on Moses, and, you know, Pharaoh commands all these baby boys to be thrown into the Nile. And Missy Sheldon's sister is like, wait a minute, you know, how does he allow that to happen? I mean, was that God's plan for these babies? You know, so she's struggling with all of that. And it becomes an opportunity for Sheldon to kind of guide her toward, you know, unbelief or whatever, you know. So, you know, as troubling as that may or may not be to someone, that, you know, it's something I think we have to wrestle with. We really have to let the full weight of those critiques come in, or we're not prepared to discuss them or to, you know, deal with them even in our own hearts and minds, much less those who we might be trying to mentor or bring along. So the response, I think, to that from Scripture, whether you like it or not, I think Scripture has responses. It's just not necessarily the ones that we want, you know. Comes right before that. If people would read the Bible together and actually give it a chance. So I know I'm getting out of John, but I'm going to circle back. Okay. So Genesis 2, we get the story of the, you know, the babies being thrown into the Nile, right? Genesis 1 is kind of the setup, Exodus 2, we get the babies in the Nile. Exodus 1, it's kind of the setup, you know, a king rose that didn't know Moses and all that, right?
Is that where they cried out? And it says the Lord heard.
Yeah. So, but in Genesis 50, right? Because we've just been given this story.
Yeah, Joseph.
Extreme injustice, you know, and how God has a greater plan even in that. And so the brothers are afraid, you know, Jacob has died, and their brothers are afraid that Joseph's going to now bring about his revenge. And so they go to him and they say, yeah, our father said, you know, ask that you show us some mercy. And, you know, maybe you don't remember that. Maybe he forgot to tell you that. I don't know if he actually did. But, you know, they're arguing that he should give them a break, even though they know they've done him wrong. Right. And his response is very interesting because he says, you know, don't be afraid. You meant it, you know. God meant it for good, even though you meant it for evil, or you meant it for evil and God meant it for good, for the saving of many lives. So what you have is dual intention. You have human intention, human will, and that will is for the evil and is for harm and hurt. It's selfish, right? And then you have divine intention in the exact same circumstances, which are for ultimate good. Now, does that mean that Joseph didn't suffer, or there weren't some sort of injustice, or that the brothers weren't somehow guilty of wrongdoing. All of that, you know, all of that's true. They were guilty. That what, you know, Joseph did suffer, that this is a painful, lamentable thing, and that there is culpability over the performing of that evil. At the same time, God has already seen that happen. He's incorporated it into his plan, you know. And so it is also his intention that all of these things would take place so that a greater good would come forth, right? So whether we can fully wrap our heads around that or not, in the midst of the, you know, the kind of the granular level tragedies on an individual human level, you know, if we can't reconcile ourselves to that, there's probably no good response to the problem of evil. Mm-hmm. You know, if one one child, you know, dying, or, you know, some horrible dictator rising up and bringing about a near genocide or whatever, all of that is too evil for our minds to imagine a greater plan surmounting it, you know, or superseding it, redeeming it even, then there's probably no answer to the problem of evil. For me, as I look at things, I'm like, you know, if there isn't a greater plan, none of it means anything, and evil is a construct. So I don't have an option but to accept that there is a greater plan, you know, because nihilism can never lead us to the future that any of us hope for or argue for a better response to human suffering than what we currently have. You know, so all that to say that the book of John is very faithful to this Hebrew tradition, this theodicy. How do you define that word, theodicy?
The justification of God. I think it's sort of, that's what it means.
Yeah.
How do we defend God against the charge that he must be evil or weak, that he allows these things?
Right. So here Jesus comes as God in the flesh, and he is, you know, his agenda is affected by, you know, a constant and mounting threat against his life. So as early as John 4, you know, Jesus learned that the Pharisees had heard that he was gaining and baptizing more disciples than John, although in fact it was not Jesus who baptized, but his disciples. So he left Judea and went back. Right, so there's this implication that he's fleeing, right? And to some degree, that's setting his agenda in John 4. Why is he in Samaria at the well, right? But then in John 4, we get that this is a divine appointment, right? Just like when Moses is fleeing Pharaoh and meets Zipporah, right? Or Jacob is fleeing Esau and meets Rachel. Yeah. So you have human evil in all three of those vignettes, right? You have the human attempt to compensate for that evil or mitigate it, at least its effects on the individual themselves. And you also have God's overarching hand bringing people together for this grand narrative. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's just one instance where Jesus is subject to these forces. Right. He's in flight. Right. I mean, you know, talk about chasing God. Right. They were, you know, but not in a good way. Yeah. So there's that. And as Jesus, and I guess I'll just continue on this thread that, you know, the story of people constantly, you know, seeking Jesus' life and its effect on his ministry and his decisions and where he works and all of that. And, you know, so Jesus is in John 7, there's this, the festival of the booths, right? Now, we've already said that Jesus is playing a little fast and loose with the festivals, right? Because he's already blown off the Passover directly prior to this by staging his own Passover in Galilee, as it were, you know, his own kind of wilderness experience out there. And so the question is he going to go to this festival? Is he just going to be a serial non-observer, you know, his brothers? And by the way, the evil kind of penetrates his own household, right? His brothers are unbelievers at this point, which is such an interesting commentary, you know, on Jesus, and it's not the only place. You know, in Mark 3, famously, they think he's crazy. They want to take him and put him in custody because they think he's crazy, right, when he has these messianic aspirations or whatever. And so, you know, his brothers are chastening him, and they're saying, hey, if you want to be seen, why aren't you doing this stuff openly? You know, you want to become a public figure. You can kind of hear that derision behind what their critique. But, you know, he decides not to go, largely because he's a target. Mm-hmm. You know, that people are wanting to kill him. But notice that, you know, later as we read into it, that he does go up in secret, but not with the entourage. And I think that it's probably for their sake that he didn't go with them, because they're looking for him with a certain group of people. Mm-hmm. You know, there's just some earmarks that are going to make him obvious, stick out like a sore thumb. Coming with this Galilean entourage into the city would have been a giveaway. And it would have been dangerous for his brothers, mm-hmm. right? But Jesus makes this comment on this kind of pernicious threat on his life, and how he approaches that, how he deals with it, okay? he says, they tell him, you know, leave. He says, and Jesus told them, my time is not yet here. For you, any time will do. So he's critiquing them. He's like, I'm living in a different wavelength than you are. Mm-hmm. My experience of life is different. I have a schedule and you don't, mm-hmm. you know. And the time he's talking about is clearly, I guess, his revelation. I mean, that's really what they've been talking about, that he would be known. But it also is his death, which for him is the one, they are the one and the mm-hmm. same. Mm-hmm. Right.
That's the revelation right. of the glory of God.
Right. And so he says, you know, my time's not here, but for you, any time will do. And we'll talk more about that. But he's just, his knowledge of what awaits him in Jerusalem, the threats that are there, the somewhat a concept of the timeline of his life and what ought to happen, the will of God seems to be informing him in the midst of all this darkness. So here you have a lot of people who are just staggering around in the dark, and they don't know, you know. There are a lot of people who stagger around and stagger right off the edge of a cliff, and they don't know, but, you know, you can't blame them. It was dark. They didn't see it. And that's kind of what he's saying, is that everybody who's out there just stimulus response living, today could be it, you know. There's really no sense of purpose, intention behind their lives. Their lives are really almost happenstance because of how they've chosen to live, mm-hmm. you know, in their own wisdom, their own sense of things, okay? But he's saying, you know, I'm going to stay on my timetable. You guys go ahead, because any time will do for you. Might as well go now, right? So they go, and he stays, and then he goes up in secret. Now, what's interesting about it is, that he goes up in secret for a few days. People are asking about him. And then halfway through this week-long festival, he pops out right in the middle of the temple. You know, so here's somebody that goes from being non-participant to incognito to just, ba-da, right? You know, just right in the middle of it all. You know, and it's almost a precursor for the kind of life that we're looking at, you know, where Jesus is here, but nobody can see him. You know, but there's coming a moment when he's going to come, and it's going to be all eyes are going to see him. You know, he's not just kind of working his way into it, right? And that's what he does here. He just, bung, you know, he's out in public. And he's preaching right in the middle of the temple, temple courts. And it's interesting, the response, right? At some point, the people in Jerusalem began to ask, isn't this a man they're trying to kill? Mm-hmm. You know, here he is speaking publicly, and they are not saying a word to him. Have the authorities really concluded that he's the Messiah? So this is a kind of a foreshadowing of how God is using the evil intentions of the unbelieving Jews to highlight who Christ is.
Okay. Now, how is that? How the evil intentions of the unbelieving Jews to highlight who Christ is?
Right. Because his public manifestation to Israel mm-hmm. in the face of their machinations to kill him, became a witness that they actually must believe in him. You know, he kind of turns it on its head. And their attempts to kill him or their desires to kill him become evidence for who he is. So there's this, the irony of it all, right? So Jesus uses this.
Demonstrating God's sovereignty over evil.
Exactly. Right. So that's the, I mean, that's the frustrating thing about evil intent against God's plan is it becomes a part of God's plan. So, you know, God is going to set the Israelites free, right? But he doesn't just do it immediately. Yeah. He does it in these ever worsening plagues, right? And I think that that's how he hardened Pharaoh's heart, because he's, there's this crescendo in the intensity and the damage done allows Pharaoh to kind of develop a callus against it. You know, he, God doesn't just lead with his most severe thing in Pharaoh's case, because he's using Pharaoh's own hardness against him, right? And so Pharaoh becomes an agent of God, even in his opposition of God. So we find with the Jewish leaders and the Pharisees, those who are conspiring to kill Jesus become the very agents of God's great plan through Jesus, in the story, right? So Jesus again talks about this idea of his being on God's timetable. So what we also get is this repeated mention that someone goes out to arrest Jesus and Jesus walks away. You know, time and again, people just get their resolve up and they go, this is, that's enough. Let's just go get him.
Right. Right. Says he like passes through them or whatever.
Right. And this kind of corroborates what he's saying in that he really can't die outside the will of God, because he's so given over to the will of God that he's going to die, obviously, right? But it's not going to be before God's ordained it, you know? So there's a frustrating of these plans. And as it's being frustrated, just like in John 7, that he is being further glorified and highlighted, right? As he seems to be defying them, you know? So the Pharisees send, in John 7 toward the end, they send their enforcers, temple guard, right? Temple guard, instead of bringing him back, they're like, man, nobody ever talked like this guy, you know? I mean, they, Jesus is like winning them over, you know, in the midst of all of this. So when you get to John 11, so really John 10 at the end, they, you know, they talk about Jesus is, you know, there's a threat on his life, right? It says that as they're processing who he is, you know, the Jews, and there's always this division between the Jews. They can't figure it out, right? Some are believers and some aren't and all that. And he says, but others said, these are not the sayings of a man possessed by a demon. Can a demon open the eyes of the blind? Again, they tried to seize him, but he escaped their grasp, right? So there's this idea that they're, you know, they're trying to grab him, but they can't, right? And then Jesus went back across the Jordan. This is at the end of John 10, to the place where John had been baptizing in the early days. There he stayed, and many people came to him. So Jesus does, he does escape, but at the same time, he relocates his ministry away from Jerusalem at John 10. So Jesus is in Jerusalem from John 7, 1, or John 7, 7 to John 10, the end, 41, right? And then he goes out into the wilderness, and that's where he's staying, and his ministry's flourishing, and people are around, he's performing miracles, everything's great, okay? Until he has a friend who has the audacity to get sick. And so John 11, 1, it says, now a man named Lazarus was sick. He was from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. And Bethany is just, you can see Jerusalem from Bethany, just a suburb, right? So that's right in the middle of the lion's den. And this is, and so the sister sent word to Jesus, okay, Lord, the one you love is sick. Now, this is loaded, okay? So to some degree, this is a manipulative approach in the sense that Jesus is surrounded by all of these people who are hearing him, and someone shouts from the crowd, you know, the one you love is sick. So what's he supposed to do?
He's supposed to go to that one.
Right.
Right, if he loves him.
Right, but there's a dilemma, right? Because he just left that area because the people there want to kill him. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's really his life versus Lazarus's, really, you know, at this point. But Jesus said this. He says, "This sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it."
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now, we know that it did end in death, but death wasn't the end, right? Mm-hmm. So he goes back, and so he, you know, when he hears this, now he's not subject to this manipulation. He hangs out for 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he doesn't just jump up and run back. And this, to me, this demonstrates the incredible balance of someone who's living for the will of God. They're not, you know, they're certainly not bound to just go and just fall on their sword and die at the first threat, you know, to their life, that the point isn't just to die, right? At the same time, there's a freedom from social pressures, okay, from beloved, right? The compulsion that comes from those whom you're supposed to love, and the compulsion that comes from the surrounding influence that says, hey, you should be loving them, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that would be a pulling force, okay? There's also freedom from the coercive force of the violent, those who would threaten, right? Or those who would do harm.
Mm-hmm.
And so Jesus waits 2 days, freedom from the compulsive force,
mm-hmm.
but also he decides to go back,
mm-hmm.
which is freedom from the coercive force.
Yeah,
so Jesus is totally free.
He heads into danger.
Right.
Right. He doesn't respond immediately
mm-hmm.
To his own maybe inner compulsion because of his love, or to their his desire to, you know, respond to her request.
Right.
He also he waits. He's got this inner compass that directs him to wait,
mm-hmm.
Or maybe he waits in order so that Lazarus will die,
right,
so that he can raise him,
yeah,
because he's got this divine intention,
mm-hmm.
and then he also doesn't respond to the fear,
right,
of the threat,
right.
He goes in the face of danger,
exactly, and so we see that Jesus is. He's dealing with painful circumstances and social pressures and the fears that people have very differently. It's a great vignette to look at what freedom looks like. And notice that Jesus is got his very clearly trained on the glory of God, not on his own reputation in front of this crowd of people, or reciprocity and the unspoken expectations of close friendships, or the coercive threat of, say, political powers and enforcing powers and things like that. So here's somebody that's just living for God's glory. And in fact, this last trip will be his last. This is him choosing to die for Lazarus. Now it's not immediate,
mm-hmm.
but it is the eventual outcome of, mm-hmm. of this trip.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And he surely knows that. Okay. So anyway, he goes and he says, now we're going back. Okay. So he waits 2 days and then he says, okay, now we're going back. Right. And the, you know, the disciples protest and they're like, but Rabbi, a short while ago, the Jews there tried to stone you. Right. I mean, this wasn't just them planning and us getting a rumor that they're wanting to arrest him. But I mean, they literally, you know, grabbed weapons and were trying to kill him. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you're going back. And Jesus answered, and this comes up with, this is another theme. It's related to what we're saying, but I'll go ahead and unpack it. He says, are there not 12 hours of daylight? Anyone who walks in the daytime will not stumble, for they see this world's light. It is when a person walks at night that they stumble and they have no light. Okay, and we could probably unpack this for quite some time, but so here's what I think this means, and you can take it or leave it, study it on your own. Okay, and I get some of this from also in John 9, where Jesus is he brings up the idea of his death. Okay. So, in John 9, we get another vignette about God's sovereignty where you have this blind man. He's blind from birth, right? So, again, this theodicy. Why did this happen? Did he sin or his parents? No, this is so that the works of God might be displayed, right? And as long as it is day, we must do the works of him who sent me. Night is coming when no one can work. While I am in the world, I am the light of the world. Okay, so same idea, right? I'm working, I'm walking in the day because night is coming. Now, for him, night was his death. Okay, mm-hmm. That's when no one can work, when you're dead, right? Mm-hmm. So you need to work while you're alive because you're going to die, and then there's a time coming when you can't work. Mm-hmm. Okay, then that seems obvious. But look at the implications. If day is life and night is death, okay, and you get down to John 11 and Jesus is like, look, we're going to go back. And they're like, weren't they trying to kill you and all this? And Jesus says, look, if you walk in the day, you won't stumble. And if you walk in the night, you will. Okay, so when I put these together, here's what I get. If we live entirely from the fear of death, we're walking in the dark. Why? Because death is the night. Mm-hmm. Okay. If we live for the glory of God without final deference to, you know, concern over death. I mean, if we just live for the glory of God, I think, you know, all this while Jesus has been avoiding death. There's probably five brushes with death that he intentionally avoids. But it's because he's in the glory, he's in the will of God, not because he's afraid to die. Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly he's not looking forward to it, but mm-hmm. He's not fleeing death. He's just chasing the will of God. Mm-hmm. Now, some of that is avoiding those who want to kill him because it wasn't his time. But I suggest to you that, and this gets back to when Jesus says, it's not my time for you, any time will do, to his brothers, okay? So those who live for the glory of God, those who live in fellowship with God without final concern over survival are walking in the day that this fellowship with God, as we've said in the past, is light, regardless of whether a person dies. Now, when we die, it's quote unquote night. We're going to rest in peace. But living in response or in avoidance to that is living in the dark. And that person's stumbling around. That person's prone to just fall backwards into the thing they're trying to avoid. Mm-hmm. You know, whereas the person who lives for the will of God is still going to die, but they won't die 1 minute before God has them planned, mm-hmm. right? Has planned for them. So they don't really have to have a fear of an untimely death because they're just living for the will of God and God knows exactly what he's doing. You know, that person has entered into this daytime living, even in the middle of a dark world. Mm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so Jesus, you know, they're saying, hey, we shouldn't go there, want to kill you. And he's like, man, if I made all my decisions based on that, I'd be walking in the dark like you guys, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's just like, I'm going to walk in the light. And that's, so for Jesus, there's, dying is obviously there. It's out ahead of him. And, you know, we would say at 33, 34, then that's an untimely death. But for Jesus, it's like, it's exactly on time. Mm-hmm. You know, he wouldn't have wanted to live to 35 or to 34 and a half, right? Because his goal isn't to see things or to buy things or to experience things or to watch his progeny grow or anything. He just has one desire. And I think that should be true of all of us so that when our time comes, as it will, mm-hmm. you know, that we're the most ready. You know, the one who lives without fear or regard, ultimately, you know, but who lives for the will of God is the most ready, because when that time comes, it's going to be exactly as it ought to be. And there's no need for regret, you know, no longing for more time or anything else. There's just simply, this is what I've been living for my whole life.
Yeah.
You know, so it's why the sovereignty of God is so important as a doctrine. When I say sovereignty, I mean his rulership over not just the positive, good, and pleasant things, but also his divine will over the things that are evil and negative and painful, because God is using those as well. Now, that doesn't mean that there's not culpability for those who perpetrate those things, or that those things are supposed to be with us forever, right?
Right.
That those things are, you know, on an overarching view, that we're really all in the night from the time of the fall till now, right? Jesus comes as light in the dark as well, but he's the morning star. He's the one that's, you know, this is the definitive end of the nighttime. It's coming, right? So all that to say that that the night is going to end, that we will have a time, but right now it has a purpose, and that purpose is, I believe, to call out those who don't want God, who aren't the called, right? It is to allow us these opportunities for forgiveness and for love and to live in this divine life, you know, to follow Christ through these difficulties and to have fellowship with him in it, and to also overcome this darkness, to bring it, to redeem all that has been. You know, how much more glorious is God when he can take, you know, if he's always the fountain of all goodness and light and everybody's basking in it all the time, you know, we'll praise his name, glory to him. If he can allow a pocket of reality to be completely filled and consumed with darkness, and then he can not only dispel that darkness, but turn it into light, mm-hmm. you know, how much more glory does, you know, belongs to him. Mm-hmm. And so the crucifixion event becomes the very nadir of darkness, right? So we get, and really in the narrative, all these trips to Jerusalem are leading to this final trip for the Passover in John 13. Okay, and in John 13, we get this reminder that Jesus is assured that he's come from the Father and he's going back to the Father. So there's this intentionality on his part. He's a full participant in his own demise, right? His own sacrifice. And then, you know, we get, and it says the evening meal was in progress. The devil had already prompted Judas, this is John 13, 2, the son of Simon Iscariot, to betray Jesus. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power. Mm-hmm. See the juxtaposition. Mm-hmm. And what we see is really almost a chiasmus. Satan prompted Judas. Jesus knew the Father. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so we have Satan's agent and the Father's agent mm-hmm. meeting at this table. And really, you know, as the narrative goes on and Jesus hands the bread with the sop to Judas, the way the seating was arranged, that Judas was to Jesus' right. You know, this is a very close encounter, right? Judas isn't across the room where some of the other disciples would have been. But you've got John the Beloved to Jesus' left, right? Because Jesus is leaning on his right arm, reclining at a table on a pillow. The table's, you know, say 18 inches off the floor. Jesus is reclining on his right arm with the, you know, and he's eating. And so John is in his bosom. Yeah. And Judas is right here at his back. Most trusted position. You know, you put the guy at your back that you trust the most. He's got your back, right?
Now, did you say because it says the one with whom I dip?
Yes, right. And so he, you know, when he dips and he has to hand it to him, he's not giving it to somebody to give to him. You can't physically reach. So in the, you know, in the arrangement of the tables in that era, especially for 12 people to be around it, you know, you've got this triclinium, mm-hmm. which is, you know, where you have three people on a short table, six people on a long table, and three people on another short table in a kind of a U shape. Okay, so you've got Jesus, Judas, Jesus, John on one side of this triclinium. Then you have, you know, Peter's probably clear across. I can't remember. You know, on the other three, they're the farthest away. You know, they always talk about, don't seek the place of honor when you go to a feast and stuff like that, right? So there's an order to the seating. Mm-hmm. And Judas is given the honorable place, apparently, right? So here's somebody that is But he was chosen as the betrayer, right? But Jesus doesn't just say, and you know, good for him, and there's going to be an honorable place for him. And no, he says, you know, the one who's handed me over to you is guilty of the greater sin. I mean, Judas is never seen as somebody who's good because God used him for the greater purpose. Judas mm-hmm. is guilty. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so we don't get the Western duality of good versus evil, but we also don't get the Eastern duality of good and evil are part of a contiguous whole. You know, that we get something that's, as far as I know, very unique to the Judeo-Christian tradition, and that is that evil is evil.
It seems like it is good versus evil, but in the sense, and evil versus good, there's an agency there, mm-hmm. and but your point is that it's not a dualism where they're equal, and God and Jesus are ruling over it.
Right. Well, but it's also not a dualism where they're unequal. It's not like the evil wins 10% and God wins 90%. I mean, God wins 100%. When evil wins, God wins. And when uh-huh. evil loses, God wins. You know, uh-huh. and that's and in evil's greatest win, God won the most. Uh-huh. You know, so yeah. there is a wiping out of that idea of the two notions in conflict. In the sense that God is using evil to bring okay. about the great good.
Okay.
You know, that there's not evil that's done that God is not aware of and isn't actively using for some greater good. Mm-hmm. At the same time, the perpetrators of that evil are guilty and the evil is still yeah. evil.
Right, right. I think that's the point I was trying to draw out. Like, I think there's a term called monergism where it's just like there is only one will mm-hmm. and there is no and all of the evil intentions are actually God's intentions. Mm-mm. And I think that's not what you're saying.
That's not, no.
You know, there are evil intentions, mm-hmm. and agents are guilty of their yes. evil intentions and actions.
Yes.
And yet God rules over them.
He does.
God overrules them. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So you have an overarching will. On the ground level, yes, evil versus good, but on the greater scheme, then God is working it out even through the evil. And so that gets to that Genesis 50. You meant it for evil. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't like those ideas didn't originate with the brothers. You know, it did. And it wasn't that those ideas, that the evil intentions were for ultimate good or for even understandable. You know, that they were evil, and that's just all there is to it. Mm-hmm. And there's culpability for it. I think there's also redemption for it, and that's why we get a lot of that story of the Joseph cycle. But, you know, when we see Judas and we see Caiaphas and those, right, we see them as people who mean to do evil, people who are causing harm, and maybe we should make a distinction, mm-hmm. you know, between harm and evil is harm, right? But evil as in a metaphysical eventuality, right? That's something that's being dispelled, you know, mm-hmm. that God's solving, right? Mm-hmm. but probably where this all really comes to a head is in, I was going to say the nighttime, right? So Jesus in John 13 and it says, then, you know, Jesus, they ask, Jesus says, one of you is going to betray me. And everybody's like, it's not me. Is it, you know? And he says, it's the one I'm going to give a piece of bread to as I dip it in the dish. Then dipping the bread, he gave it to Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot. As soon as Judas took the bread, Satan entered into him. Mm-hmm. So Jesus told him, what you're about to do, do quickly, you know? Here we have somebody who's not, you know, he's not trying to resist or anything. Mm-hmm. The Judas has a purpose, okay? And so then since Judas had charged the money, some thought Jesus said, was telling him to buy what was needed for the festival or to give something to the poor. As soon as Judas had taken the bread, he went out and it was night. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, this is intentional, mm-hmm. right? So there's a nightfall. Jesus had spoken of a time that's coming when
yeah.
the devil would have some sort of preeminence, that he, you know, his intentions would be fulfilled without restraint. Until now, there's been restraint. Okay. Mm-hmm. But when night falls, and I think that there are times through history when night falls, mm-hmm. I think Hitler's Germany, mm-hmm. Stalin's Russia mm-hmm. are times when the night has fallen, when there's just no way to, you know, that we scratch our heads. How has this happened? You know, how did Hitler just survive 13 assassination attempts? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, that there's a power at work, a dark power at work during those periods of time that we would call where the night is very deep and dark, where the political powers and the forces of evil have kind of joined. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's fully night. Okay. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that there's that timing element to God's sovereignty. What I wanted to point out before we close is just this whole thing where Caiaphas speaks up, right? So Jesus, back in John 11, Jesus has raised Lazarus. His fame is growing to its zenith. Everybody's going after him. The Pharisees are so desperate to quash this movement. They even want to kill Lazarus again, right? I mean, they're just like collateral damage, okay? And they express their frustration around verse 47. It says, the chief priests and Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin. What are we accomplishing, they asked. Here is this man performing many signs. And if we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. And it's just dripping with irony, you know. And then the Romans will come and take away our temple and our nation. And then one of them named Caiaphas, who was a high priest that year, spoke up. You know nothing at all. You do not realize that it is better for you that one man die for the people than that the whole nation perish. Now, here you can hear the hiss of Satan behind this guy's voice, right? You can hear this just really Machiavellian approach, mm-hmm. okay, mm-hmm. to just human life. Okay, and yet John's commentary is he did not say this on his own, but as a high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the Jewish nation, and not only for that nation, but also for all the scattered children of God, to bring them together and make them one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. John is just seeing in retrospect, look at how God overruled this satanic and yes. Machiavellian agenda.
Right. Right. And he even calls it prophecy, right? Mm-hmm. That God is even using this guy's position. He's gifting him mm-hmm. with this ability to prophesy what's going to happen, even in the midst of his deep rebellion.
Yeah. That's the same as Joseph's, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good.
It is. Mm-hmm. It is. And so the death of Christ becomes, just like every other great truth about God, you know, that the crucifixion and resurrection are an eternal ensign for this truth. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that God comes and he is subject to human evil. And human evil is manifested in that revelatory moment. Our capacity for evil is indicted. Evil individually through Judas, right? Evil corporately through these guys conspiring. Evil politically through Pilate, you know, that humankind, the people and the nations, you know, why did the nations rage and the people imagine a vain thing? Mm-hmm. You know, so this is the two kind of people on earth if you're a Jew, right? The nations and the people. And nobody's good here in this story, right? They conspired against the Lord and against his anointed, mm-hmm. you know. So, and just quoting the psalm. So, you know, there's this conspiracy of evil that humankind, you know. And so the gospel indicts that. It takes away our illusions about essential human goodness or the hope that humans will evolve to a place where we'll build utopia. You know, this isn't happening. It's not coming, right? At the same time, it gives us a confidence to live like Jesus did, free of compulsion and coercion for the sake of God's will, knowing that he is sovereign even when horrible things happen. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like he's been defeated. And so, and that's this ongoing call to abide because should there, you know, be some sort of persecution, should we face that, or for people in places where night has fallen, if you will, the one call is to stay the course, to stand, to remain, and in that remaining is the fruit, it is the redemption, it is the overcoming of the world, which is exactly what Jesus has done as our great martyr, the witness, and what we are called to do through our faith. So,
Thanks everybody for listening. And if you've got questions, you can always email us to discussion@recoverfaith.org. We will see you next time.